for food.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
We draw your attention to verses 54 and 55 of chapter Araf from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. إِنَّ رَبَّكُمُ اللَّهُ الَّذِي خَلَقَ السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضَ فِي سِتَّةِ أَيَّامٍ خلق السماوات والأرض في ستة أيام ثم استوى على العرش يغشي الليل النهار يطلبه حثيثا والشمس والقمر والنجوم مسخرات بأمره ألا له الخلق والأمر تبارك الله رب العالمين ادعوا ربكم تضرعا وخفية ادعوا ربكم تضرعا وخفية إنه لا يحب المعتدين. صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Surely your Lord is Allah, who created the heavens and the earth in 6 periods of time, and He is firm in power. He throws the veil of night over the day, which it pursues incessantly, and He created the sun and the moon and the stars, made subservient by His command. Surely His is the creation and the command. Blessed is Allah, the Lord of the worlds. Call on your Lord humbly and secretly. Surely He does not love those who exceed the limits.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Here's a look at our top stories this hour. A senior Iranian official says the Islamic Republic will respond in kind to any measure taken against its national security from any neighboring country. A top Russian security official says the refusal of NATO members to recognize Moscow's authority over Crimea represents a, quote, systemic threat to its country. Also ahead, a shooting at a mall in the U.S. state of Indiana leaves 3 people dead and several more injured, the latest in a spate of gun violence in the country. Hello and welcome from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you for joining us. A senior Iranian official says the Islamic Republic will respond in kind to any measure by neighboring countries against its national security. Kamal Kharozi, head of Iran's Strategic Council on Foreign Relations, was referring to the countries that have normalized ties with Israel. He stressed that targeting Iran's security by those countries will also be met with a direct response to Israel. Kharozi pointed to Iran's extensive military drills, saying they aim to send a message that Iran is capable of hitting targets deep inside Israel in case its vital and sensitive facilities are targeted. He also rejected allegations that Iran is in pursuit of nuclear weapons, saying the Islamic Republic has no such intention despite technical capabilities to do so. Iran has dismissed accusations by U.S. President Biden that it is carrying out destabilizing activities in West Asia. Tehran says the U.S. is trying to foment tension in West Asia by resorting to the failed policy of Iranophobia. Earlier, we discussed the issue in our news review program. Let's take a listen.
Time now for the news review. Iran says the United States is trying to foment tension and crisis in West Asia by resorting to the failed policy of Iranophobia. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani made a comment in reaction to the U.S. president, who's accused Iran of destabilizing activities in West Asia. He also slammed Biden for raising false allegations regarding Tehran's peaceful nuclear energy program while ignoring decades of deception by the Tel Aviv regime as the largest possessor of nukes in the region. During an address to the GCC Plus 3 summit in Jeddah, Biden said the United States will remain as an active player in the region, and I will not walk away to leave, quote, a vacuum to be filled by China, Russia, or Iran. Now, that was the story. Time now to get some insight on this. So joining me will be a couple of guests from Tehran, Fuad Izzati, professor of international studies with the University of Tehran. Also with us will be Tohid Esadi. He's a political commentator. Good to see you, gentlemen. Now, Professor Izzati, U.S. won't walk away from the region to... that was really funny, to let Iran, Russia, and China... Well, why should the U.S. be in this region? I mean, what if we do the same thing in other parts of the world? I mean, regional countries are there. They have regional issues. Iran has its own proposal. Russia, China, others, other players in the region, they know what to do with their own issues. Why should the U.S. be in this region? And now we have Mr. Biden saying we will never walk away. Why should there be he in the first place?
You know, it does sound, if you look at the history of the last number of decades, especially after World War II, the Middle East, the West, used to be an American backyard. Americans used to control Iran. They used to, and still control, and many other states in this part of the world. Majority of the states in West Asia were American clients. And 43 years ago, with the Islamic Revolution in Iran, and then you had Americans basically coming under pressure from what the resistance movements, and Iran leading that movement, to make sure that of this region and interests of the people of the region are addressed without interference from the United States. And the situation, as we speak, is very difficult for the United States. You have countries like Russia and China that have also increased in this part of the world. And the United States president feels that he needs to publicly, the United States will not leave. Why would he have to say that? Because a lot of countries are basic that the United States is a power in decline, and they are making other choices. You look at the coverage of Biden's visit, quite negative. He failed to achieve most of the goals that he had. And I think this is another indication that United States standing in this part of the world is weakening as we speak.
Okay. Now, Tohid, let's take a look at this part of Mr. Biden's comment accusing Iran of fomenting tension and crisis. What's he talking about? I mean, I just don't get it, because what crisis? In Syria, for example, the Damascus government asked Iran to go and give some advisor, military advisor help. Iraqis asked for Iran help. We had General Soleimani and his colleagues fighting and helping Iraqis uproot. Is this fomenting tension and destabilizing move?
Well, I think all in all, Biden's recent trip to the occupied Palestine in Saudi Arabia takes place after former President Trump's unilateral rancorous policies against Iran failed. Therefore, Biden tries to kind of make a regional consensus against Iran to continue the very obnoxious policies, which is, as Professor Izzati mentioned, part of a grand strategy of colonization and new neo-colonization. So here, there are a couple of points. Actually, much have been said regarding your question, but I would like to touch upon a couple of facts rather than analysis. Fact number one is that Biden claims that it is trying to create kind of stability in the region. That is on the one hand. And on the other hand, we know that between 2016 and 2020, according to a CPRI report, almost half of U.S. arm exports has gone to countries in the Middle East. So the serious question to be asked here is that Is the United States trying to make stability in the region by selling weaponries, this is just one side of the coin. Another point is that after President Raisi came to the office, the entire effort of the current government was to develop better relations with the regional countries. Mm-hmm. And just assuming the fact that if Tehran and Riyadh could improve their relations, how huge the impact could be upon the energy market, and how huge this impact could be on the United States in a very negative way, is something that the United States pretty much aware of and is pretty much aware of its dangers. So Biden, it's interesting, it expresses concerns of regional activities. We know that his country is the same country that attacked Afghanistan, attacked Iraq, Syria, and so far and so forth. So the list goes on. At the same time, this is Iran that in past four decades has not started any war. And again, it's very interesting. The United States refers to Israeli concerns about Iran's activities. And here, the question is that which one is more dangerous? The Israeli regime, which possesses nuclear warheads, is not a signatory of NPT, has already occupied a country and regularly attacks other countries, other Arab countries. So this country puts forth this baseless claim that Iran is a kind of sole concern or threat to the region. These are all contradictory lines of argument that has been by the West in order to provide a very negative picture of Iran to the world. And I think if you just take a look at the realities on the ground, truth is something else compared to what has been put forth by the United States and its Western allies.
Now, thank you so much, Fuad Izzadi and Tohid Esadi, both of them in Tehran. Thank you for your insight and contribution.
Welcome back. Former Russian President Dmitry Medvedev has reiterated that Crimea is part and parcel of his country. Medvedev also called for the recognition of Moscow's sovereignty over the region. He said the refusal of Ukraine and NATO to recognize Crimea as part of Russia represents a systemic and direct threat to his country. He underlined that Crimea, which rejoined Russia following a referendum in 2014, is now Russian soil. Medvedev's comments were aired a day after the Ukrainian military warned that Crimea could be a target for U.S.-made missiles, recently deployed by Kiev as it is battling Russian forces. Kiev called it a justified target of attack, claiming that Russia had carried out strikes on its territories from Crimea and the Black Sea. Ukraine's president has abruptly sacked the head of the country's domestic security agency and the state prosecutor general, citing suspected treason in their agencies. Volodymyr Zelensky says he fired the top officials over reports that hundreds of their staff members had collaborated with Russia. He says this problem has touched other agencies as well. He says the sheer number of alleged treason cases showed a challenge his country is facing amid Russia's military operations. The firings are the biggest of their kind since Russia launched this operation in Ukraine. The economic impact of the war and the sanctions on Russia is showing across the world. Inflation is up in many countries, global supply chains have been disrupted, and there are fears of food shortages. But now economists fear the situation in Europe could further deteriorate as the continent struggles to find middle grounds on solutions to the current uncertainties.
Gas supplies to Europe have tightened and fuel costs have soared since Russia's conflict with Ukraine in February and subsequent sanctions, leaving countries scrambling to refill storage and diversify supply channels. But despite the heavy costs incurred by their citizens, the Russophobia sentiment by many EU countries, especially those with close ties with the US, continues unabated. The Netherlands, Germany, Poland, and Italy are just some of the European countries who are buyers of Russian oil. But now the EU seems to have imposed sanctions on Moscow without having a plan for life without cheap Russian energy. A clear example of sanctions backfiring would be Germany, which recently reported its first trade deficit in 30 years. While the sanctions on Russia were meant to pressure Moscow in light of its special operation in Ukraine, the backfiring of the EU measures have given birth to disagreements between politicians in the bloc. The Hungarian Prime Minister has said that a failure in rolling back the sanctions on Russia risks the destruction of the European economy. Viktor Orban said European leaders should reconsider their strategy, as sanctions have caused widespread damage to the European economy without weakening Russia or bringing the months-long war closer to any resolution.
Absolutely. I think that the Hungarian leader, Viktor Orban, right now is saying what is meant to be unsaid and unspoken, is that basically the sanctions, this pressure campaign from the European Union against Russia because of Russia's special military operation in Ukraine is having a blowback, as the CIA used to put the term, in that the sanctions are actually working against the European economy. And what Orban was addressing was the fuel crisis that exists right now, compounded with the inflation that we see around the world. We're looking at fuel prices increasing, fuel shortages, and issues with fuel supply and logistics to get that fuel to the European market and to many of the nations. Remember that Hungary is landlocked, so it imports most of its oil via pipeline. And so right now we are witnessing a pretty catastrophic next few months and what some people are predicting to be a very tough winter for Europe.
Moving on, another shooting in the United States. A gunman opens fire inside a mall in the state of Indiana, killing three and wounding two others before being shot dead.
What we do know right now is that we have what appears to be one shooter. Looks to be an adult male. We have not identified him yet. We do not have a motive yet. It appears that he had a rifle with several magazines of ammunition, entered the food court, and began shooting. We have five victims. Four have been confirmed deceased, and two are at Eskenazi Hospital with wounds, and we do not have an update on their condition at this time.
Officials say the gunman, who was alone, was shot by an armed bystander at the mall. Police say they are investigating the incident. This is the latest in a spate of gun violence in the U.S. Recent incidents include a shooting at an elementary school in Texas that left 19 children and two teachers dead. A new report by Texas state lawmakers slammed law enforcement's slow response to the shooting, saying more decisive action could have saved lives. The incidents have ignited debates over the necessity of stricter gun control laws. This week, a committee in the U.S. House of Representatives would vote on a bill that bans assault rifles. The vote is a first in over 20 years. And with that, we'll come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrors fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need, which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willst, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Qadir, the perfection of faith. In the name of God, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Salam, everybody, and heartiest congratulations to you all. Today is that immortal day in history when God Almighty, as the Noble Quran says in Ayah 3 of Surah Ma'idah, perfected faith, completed his blessings on the Ummah, and decreed Islam to be the religion of all mankind. It is the day known in Islamic history as Eid al-Qadir. As a matter of fact, it is the greatest of all Eids, because on this day, the one and only Creator resolved the issue of succession to the last and greatest messenger, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. It is the 18th of Dhul-Hajjah, on which in the year 10 AH, while returning from his farewell Hajj pilgrimage, the Prophet halted at the place called Khum, beside the Qadir or pond near Jufa, on revelation of an express divine commandment. He called on all those who had proceeded ahead to come back, and waited for all those who lagged behind to come to this place. Then, after a memorable sermon to the huge gathering of 120,000 people, he lifted the hand of his dear cousin and son-in-law, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him, and proclaimed him vicegerent. Please stay with us for an exclusive program on this blessed day, which is a public holiday in Iran, where celebrations are being held since last night all over the country, including in the capital Tehran, which this year is hosting a grand festival in the afternoon on a 10 kilometers long stretch of Vali Asr Street, with a special religious cultural performances to highlight the significance of the occasion, and of course, gift packages, competitions, and presents for children. O Prophet, communicate that which has been sent down to you from your Lord, and if you do not, you will not have communicated his message, and Allah shall protect you from the evil of people. Indeed, Allah does not guide the faithless lot. This is how God addresses the Prophet in Ayah 67 of Surah Ma'idah. The words are clear. The message is urgent and has to be communicated. The tone is rather stern and means to say the outcome of all 23 years of the mission of the Prophet depends on his immediate carrying out of this express divine commandment. The tone of the All-Merciful God is reassuring as well. The Almighty promises the Prophet protection from the evil of the wicked people, which means the worst seditious person amongst the pilgrims who did not like to obey God's commandment out of jealousy for the prime position of Imam Ali, peace upon him. This historic event occurred in the wilderness beside a pond of fresh water, perhaps to signify the perennial freshness of this event. It capped the 23-year mission of the Seal of Messengers that had begun at Cave Hira on Mount Nur in Mecca, where the 10-year-old Ali, peace upon him, was also present when Archangel Gabriel descended with the first ayahs of the Noble Quran. The day chosen by God for this great phenomenon had seen certain miracles in antiquity, such as the turning into a flower garden of the huge fire the tyrant Nimrod had ignited and flung Prophet Abraham into it. This is yet another indication that even the most intricate plots of the faithless will come to naught against the epitome of faith that emerged at Qadir. It is interesting to note that it was on the 18th of Dhul-Hajjah that Prophet Moses, as per divine commandment, had designated Prophet Joshua as his successor. Some centuries later, on this particular day, Prophet Solomon had appointed Asaf, the son of Barchia, as his deputy. And it was this very same day when Prophet Jesus had named Simon as his vicegerent. Thus, on the 18th of Dhul-Hajjah, in the year 10 AH, when the Prophet of Islam, after a memorable midday sermon under the blazing sun, extracted the pledge of obedience to his superiority over all others from the huge assembly of 120,000 pilgrims, and then lifted his cousin to proclaim, "For whomsoever I am master, this Ali is his master." He was not saying anything from himself. In fact, like the prophets of the past, he was only announcing what God had commanded him to do in order to fix a permanent criterion for humanity to recognize true faith. It is interesting to note that God did not command the prophet to declare a successor. Any ordinary person of Arabia who had spent the greater part of life in idolatry and vices before paying lip service to monotheism. This would have been against the principles of divine justice. This would have been contrary to the course of events since the day of Mab'ath, when, in the solitude of Cave Hira, Archangel Gabriel had descended to the 40-year-old son of Abdullah with the first rays of divine revelation, while outside stood a 10-year boy. The boy heard whatever that transpired, and as mentioned in all authoritative texts, even those written by our Sunni brethren such as the Musnad of Ahmad ibn Hanbal, the prophet had told the 10-year boy, "O Ali, you are my legatee and my caliph." Later, when the Prophet invited the Arabs of Mecca for a banquet, arranged for them a good meal, testified the oneness of God and his mission as the last and greatest messenger of Islam, and called for an assistant in his mission who would be caliph after him, the gathering exchanged stupefied looks. The silence was broken up by a preteen boy who stood up and testified to the prophethood of his cousin and volunteered to help him carry out the divine mission. It had happened 3 times, and here also the prophet said in explicit words that Ali would be his legatee and caliph after him. He proved to be the staunchest supporter and never for a single moment left his elder cousin alone. As a youth, he volunteered to sleep on the prophet's bed on the night of Hijra, so that the latter could leave Mecca for Medina. Undetected from the Arab assassins hovering around the abode of divine revelation, then in Medina, this brave young man single-handed defeated the Arab infidels and the Israelite warlords in almost every armed encounter they imposed upon the prophet. The prophet in turn always recounted the merits of his cousin, who was now married to his only surviving child, the impeccable daughter Fatima, peace upon her. It was clear that he was second only to the prophet. In several ayahs of the Noble Quran, God has testified to the unsurpassable merits of Imam Ali, peace upon him, whether in the thick of battle, whether in the parley and subsequent mubahale with the Christians, or whether in terms of piety, faith, and wisdom. In view of these undeniable facts, the all-wise and just God commanded the prophet to publicly proclaim Imam Ali, peace upon him, as vicegerent before the massive gathering of pilgrims. Archangel Gabriel promptly descended with tidings from the divine court. Today the faithless have despaired of your religion, so do not fear them, but fear me. Today I have perfected your religion for you, and I have completed my blessing upon you, and I have approved Islam as your religion. The rest is history. Every single person from the huge gathering of 120,000 Hajj pilgrims, including women for whom a separate arrangement had been made to give the pledge by dipping their hands in a water tub, surged to congratulate Imam Ali, peace upon him, and swear allegiance to his leadership. They thus delegitimize forever any bid in the future by any person other than the infallible Ahlul Bayt to call himself Caliph or successor of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. It took 3 days for the whole congregation to pledge allegiance to Imam Ali, peace upon him, as the Prophet's divinely designated vicegerent. The formal declaration of the leadership of Imam Ali, peace upon him, thus set up an everlasting barometer for discerning truth from falsehood, and it made the faithless despaired for distorting Islam, as had been done by impostors with the messages entrusted to the prophets of the past. Now we understand why divine providence has decreed that Imam Mahdi, peace upon him, who would reappear in the end times with Prophet Jesus as his lieutenant to establish the global government of peace and justice, will be the direct descendant of Imam Ali and the Prophet's immaculate daughter, Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace upon them, and not the offspring of any of those who had masqueraded as caliphs to terrorize Muslims. In view of these irrefutable facts, without the least doubt, the day of Qadir, according to the Prophet's sixth infallible heir, Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace upon him, is the greatest Eid in Islam, more significant than Eid al-Fitr and Eid al-Adha, because this day decided the continuation of divine guidance for humanity, despite the plots of the seditious, such as the scandalous gathering of Saqifah Bani Sa'idah. Interestingly, we read in the famous ziyarat of the Commander of the Faithful on the day of Qadir the following passage, which is almost self-explanatory. I affirm that you are the one who is meant by the words of the Almighty and the All-Merciful in Ayah 153 of Surah An'am. This indeed is my straight path, so follow it and do not follow other ways, for they will separate you from his way. By God, those who follow others besides you have gone astray and misled others, and those who are hostile toward you deviate from the truth. O Allah, we have heard your command, and we obey and follow your straight path, so guide us, our Lord. Do not make our hearts swerve after you have guided us, and enable us to be of those who are grateful for your blessings. O Commander of the Faithful, I affirm that those who have doubts about your imamat do not have faith in the trusted prophet, and that those who put others on a par with you deviate from the upright religion, which has been approved for us by the Lord of all the worlds, who perfected it with your wilayat. Happy Qadir to all, and goodbye.
Qadir celebrates the divine appointment of Imam Ali, peace be upon him, the cousin and son-in-law of the Holy Prophet, as Prophet Muhammad's vicegerent and successor. Congratulations to all our Muslim listeners on the auspicious occasion of Eid Qadir.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. On this program, we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, communities, and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss how the tradition of Qawwali, a blend of music and mysticism in praise of Imam Ali, gained astounding popularity in South Asia over the centuries. And we shall also take a look at the dramatic turn in the months-long protests in Sri Lanka, with demonstrators laying siege to residences of President and Prime Minister.
A celebration of divine and unadulterated love that transcends the boundaries of caste, color, and creed, Qawwali is a seamless fusion of music, spirituality, and mysticism. It's rooted in the Persian and Indian linguistic and cultural traditions that gained popularity in South Asia, courtesy of ascetics, mystics, and scholars of Islam. At the heart of this timeless Sufi tradition is Ali ibn Abi Talib, the first Shia Imam. Qawwali is sung essentially in praise of his lofty virtues, bravery, sagacity, and asceticism.
Qawwali
The profoundly spiritual and mystic melody associated with Qawwali seeks to bring listeners closer to the Almighty and His best creation. It starts with Hamd as an expression of gratitude and gratefulness for Allah. It then moves to Nat, the panegyric verses in praise of Prophet Muhammad, before the final and most critical element of Manqabat that eulogizes Imam Ali.
There is something in Qawwali which attracts everybody, attracts someone, attracts your inner, attracts your soul to be listened.
Dating back to the 13th century, the path-breaking tradition of Qawwali was introduced by Amir Khusro Dehlavi, the celebrated Indian Sufi saint and a disciple of Hazrat Nizamuddin, a Sufi luminary whose popular shrine in Delhi reverberates with the soulful tune of Qawwalis today. One of the most famous Qawwalis of Amir Khusro is derived from the prophetic tradition Man Kuntu Mawla, Prophet Muhammad's historic declaration at Qadir Khum in 10 Hijri that Ali is his worthy successor, which has been immortalized by legendary Sufi artists, including Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan, Abida Parveen, and Sabri Brothers. Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan's famous Urdu Qawwali, Ali Mawla, declares that knowing Ali is knowing Allah. While one Punjabi Qawwali says, truth is Ali. Ghulame Ali is another timeless Sufi hymn in honor of Imam Ali, which reveals astounding devotion to Imam Ali through the spiritual, meditative experience of Qawwali.
Dating back to the 13th century, the tradition of Qawwali gained massive popularity in the 20th century, with legendary South Asian artists taking it to the global stage. Most Qawwalis today are in Hindi, Urdu or Punjabi languages, but the influence of the Persian language is hard to miss. In recent decades, the traditional art of Qawwali has been modernized by prominent artists in India and Pakistan, and mainstream cinema in India has also enthusiastically adopted it.
Amir Khusro Dehlavi, who belonged to the Chisti order of Sufis, pioneered the mystic art of Qawwali through his epic rendition of Man Kuntu Mawla in the late 13th century. Over the centuries, other soulful Sufi melodies made their way into the Qawwali repertoire, popularized in the 20th century by the likes of Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan, Sabri Brothers, Abida Parveen, and Farid Ayaz. Essentially in praise of Imam Ali, Qawwalis are today performed in both Shia and Sunni gatherings in South Asian countries as a symbol of syncretic culture. Quite remarkably, with the advent of satellite television and digital technology, Qawwalis have crisscrossed long distances. In India, artists such as Oscar winner A.R. Rahman made Qawwalis trendy with chartbuster songs like Khauja Mir Khauja and Kun Fayakun. In Pakistan, TV programs such as Coke Studio in Pakistan have been instrumental in making Qawwalis a household phenomenon. More recently, top Pakistani singer Ali Zafar created a buzz with his Qawwali Mawla, a tribute to Imam Ali.
Now to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Bilal Chashti, formerly known as Dhruv Sangari before his conversion to Islam. He is a Sufi musician and scholar, singer for Ruh Sufi Ensemble from New Delhi, India. Mr. Chashti, welcome to the program, sir. Now, the Sufi tradition of Qawwali has come a long way in South Asia since Amir Khosrow Dehlavi in the 13th century. What makes it so popular and evergreen?
So now you come to the fact that the Sufi tradition and what makes it so popular. So it is this kind of syncretic blending of different traditions, right? Transgressing boundaries, blending of traditions. What we know in India as Tehzeeb-e Gango Jaman or the Majma'ul Bahrain. And it is the blending of civilizations, of traditions, to create a very long-term harmonious civilization which believes in celebrating each other's festivals, learning about each other's spiritual traditions, cultural traditions. And through that sharing comes a music, which is what is actually Qawwali. Qawwali is a success story of the secular syncretic tradition of the Indian subcontinent, actually. And in Qawwali, we see so many different forms of music are combined, from the Dhrupad and the Bhajan and the Kirtan of the Hindu traditions to everything from the Hamd, Qaul, Manqabat, Naat, everything, and the Marsiya of the Persio-Arabic traditions. So Qawwali is something very fluid. It doesn't have any one description, which is why in any one Qawwali concert or any one Qawwali program, even at a Sufi Dargah or a Khanqah, you will find the Durveshes, the Samakhwan, they sing a vast variety of genres. And this is why Qawwali, till today, is unique and appeals to people across religions, across cultures, across nations, across boundaries. And this is exactly the idea behind the Sufis propagating Qawwali in their shrines and in their khanqahs.
Mr. Chashti, Qawwalis are sung essentially in praise of Almighty Allah, Prophet Muhammad and Imam Ali, with specific focus on Manqabat of the first Shia Imam. Now, can we say, or could we say, that this is a celebration of love?
Most Sufis, with the exception of a few Salasil, they date back their Shijra all the way to Mawla Ali, to Hazrat Ali, Karamullahu Wajhul Kareem, for them, one of the most important declarations of the unity of faith, as represented by the Ahle Bayt Uzzam and Mustafa Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, Sarkar Idwalam, is the events of the Ghadir, which take place in fact this month in Zulhijjah, where Huzur Muhammad Saab lifts up the hand of Mawla Ali radiallahu anhu, and he says, Man kuntu Mawlahu wa haza Aliyun Mawlahu. So this, and then there are other hadith where he is, and this is both shared by both Sunni and Shia, historians and muhaddis. So this is something which people have an ijma on. There's another very famous hadith which says, "Ana Madinatul Ilm wa Aliyun Babuha." So such very beautiful examples of how the regardless of whoever was the administrator of some place or not, the spiritual successor of Huzur Muhammad Saab is very much, the Ahle Bayt. And to celebrate that is a very, very important part of the Sufi tradition. And it is the love of the Ahle Bayt. You know, the Ahle Bayt are described as almost like a kashti-e-noor. You know, they are described as a great jahaz, a ship, where those who climb on will go celebrating in love and will be forgiven at the end. So this is a tasawwur which is extremely important. And this tasawwur has also been borrowed by people of other faiths, which is so beautiful. The Hindus, the Sikhs, they used to very actively celebrate, not celebrate, but mark the solemn occasions of, the shahadat of the imams, Muharram, the events at Karbala, and even today in the Taziyas, in the Marsiyas, And you know, in the ceremonies of a lot of the Shia community, you find there are Hindus, there are many Sunnis, there are Sufis also, there are people from the Sikh faith.
Mr. Chashti, when we talk of Urdu or Punjabi or even Persian Qawwalis, the one name that comes to mind is that of legendary Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan. How do you see his contribution in popularizing Qawwalis globally?
So Ustad Nusrat Ali Khan Sahab, marhoom, rahmatullahi alayhi, was one of the most legendary musicians of his time. In fact, a lot of people lovingly call him God of Music, if there is such a thing. But he was really, really blessed, and I was very blessed to learn from him, spend time with him in the last 1.5 to 2 years of his life. Subsequently, I was also under the guidance of late Ustad Farooq Fateh Ali Khan Sahab, who is the father of Ustad Rahat Fateh Ali Khan Sahab. So these people, they were really, at their time, once in a century, you know, we see musicians like this come around.
Mr. Chashti, thank you for being on the program. He's a Sufi musician and scholar, singer for Ruh Sufi Ensemble from New Delhi, India. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Sarah Tassir, a Lahore-based designer and social activist, notes that Sufi saints such as Nizamuddin Awliya and Amir Khosro spread the message of Islam in the subcontinent through arts like Qawwali before Mughals. Islamic scholar Omid Safi says almost every Qawwali session starts with praise of God, followed by praise of the Prophet, and then praise of Imam Ali, describing it as the model of spiritual transmission. Holland Khan, a Sufism devotee, lauds legendary Qawwali artist Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan for registering his name in the Guinness Book of World Records by recording 125 Qawwali albums.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
In what turned out to be the island country's most chaotic and tumultuous day in months-long anti-government protests, angry protesters on Saturday, July the 9th, stormed President Gotabaya Rajapaksa's residence in the Sri Lankan capital, Colombo, and called for his resignation. They also made their way into Prime Minister Ranil Wickremesinghe's residence, setting it on fire as anger over the political and economic crisis gripping the country boiled to unprecedented levels. Protesters also ambushed a cricket stadium where the Sri Lankan team was playing against Australia.
In spectacular scenes broadcast live on Sri Lankan television and circulated widely over social media, hundreds of protesters were seen gate-crashing Sri Lankan President Gotabaya Rajapaksa's colonial-era fortified residence and office on Saturday.
The moment we are struggling to chase off Gotabaya and Ranil Wickremesinghe, the Prime Minister and President of Sri Lanka.
Images show demonstrators sitting in the president's boardroom, hanging banners from the balcony, and swimming in the small courtyard pool. Rajapaksa had fled the scene, moving to a safe location, before hell broke loose. Protesters then stormed the residence of veteran politician and sitting Prime Minister Ranil Wickremesinghe and set it on fire. Demonstrators from different parts of the country marched to the capital, Colombo, demanding the resignation of both Rajapaksa and Wickremesinghe over deepening economic mismanagement. To draw the attention of foreign governments, they also gathered outside a cricket stadium in Sri Lanka's southern coastal city of Gale, where the home team was playing against Australia.
So we are here to purposely show the whole country that the steps taken by the government to constrict the democratic space, the democratic rights of the people of the country is a violation of the Constitution.
In an attempt to thwart anti-government demonstrations, authorities had on Friday night imposed a stringent curfew in Colombo. But the curfew was lifted after civil society groups and opposition parties expressed their objection and protesters stood unfazed. Strung by massive public anger, President Rajapaksa finally agreed to resign. Prime Minister Wickremesinghe also said he will step down after a new government is formed.
The tumultuous events in Sri Lanka marked the culmination of months of violent anti-government protests fueled by the worst economic crisis the country has seen since its independence in 1948. What started as peaceful demonstrations in February over rampant inflation and shortage of food and fuel took a dramatic turn recently with angry protesters laying siege to the residences of both the president and the prime minister. Observers have pinned the blame for the crisis on the Rajapaksa family, which has for decades dominated the island's politics.
Lengthy blackouts, rampant inflation, and acute shortage of food and medicine have forced people in the island country to take to the streets in large numbers in recent months. The anger over the simmering crisis in the country of 22 million has mainly been directed at the Rajapaksa family, the country's most powerful political dynasty that has dominated the political scene in Sri Lanka for almost two decades.
Actually, the current situation in the country is getting worse. There's no fuel in the country. There is no basic needs like electricity, food.
In the last few years, Sri Lankan rupee has lost more than 80% of its value. Food costs have skyrocketed, and the tourism industry remains in shambles. Last week, the government shut off fuel sales over concerns it would run out of petroleum, becoming the first country to do so since the oil crisis of the